thank you most of all for Jesus, who died for us. It's in his name we pray.
Amen. As we're looking at this part of the book of Deuteronomy, we're looking at, especially now in these next few chapters, some of the very detailed conditions of the law that was laid down by Moses, or through Moses, by God, for these people in this covenant relationship with God that they were undertaking. Now, I want you to notice as we go through, though, there are a lot of things that have to do with principles that God expects and has always expected out of his people. But then there are the implementation details that are specific to this covenant, which we'll see aren't always carried over into his other covenant. So we have to make a distinction between the covenants. We've talked about that many times. We're not under the same covenant, the same laws. But a lot of times the things that we're looking at here, we can see what God had in mind, what he was trying to accomplish with his people. And many times there are analogies. There are things that God still wants out of his people. It's just that they're accomplished in slightly different ways. And I think we'll see a couple of examples of that as we go through this section. But there are some overall principles. And I want you to look down at the at chapter 14. Let's get the right page here. Chapter 12, beginning in verse 29. Now when the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations which you are going in to dispossess, and you dispossess them and dwell in their land, beware that you are not ensnared to follow them, after they are destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods, that I also may do likewise? You shall not behave thus toward the Lord your God. For every abominable act which the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. For they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to or take away from it. Now, God's going to lay down a lot of very detailed things here. But what's the general principle that he has in mind when it comes to how people should deal with his law? What's he say there? Do what you're told, right? He makes it fairly straightforward there at the end. There's really only two ways you can change something, right? What do? Add stuff to it, right? Or what? Take stuff away from it, right? And that's really about all it amounts to when you've got something right in front of you. And we see that with, especially with our kids, you know, when you lay down the laws and things for them, right? Aren't they good at finding the loopholes? Very good at finding the loopholes. But you didn't say not to do this exact thing, leaving off the general principles. And so God says here, now, I'm going to give you a bunch of specifics, but the main thing is, don't start adding things in. Don't start taking things away. You're not supposed to be inventing your own rules here. God's going to lay down enough of them that they've got plenty to worry about. But especially, what were they not to look around and see? Yeah. Was God's law some sort of compilation of picking and choosing the nations around them or what they saw? No, God had laid down his own laws. And when they went into this land, the thing that you're going to see here that's going to be a common theme through a lot of these chapters, these people are a little rough. They've been honed for 40 years in the wilderness to try to depend on Jehovah God. But they're going to be put into the middle of a place where Jehovah God is not known. Okay, one of the reasons that they're coming in, just a chapter before, he said, I'm not giving you this land because you guys are so good. I'm giving you this land because the people that are in it are bad and it's time for them to be punished. So he doesn't want them going in and adopting the nations around them, melding in, becoming one of them. They needed to be separate. And he really emphasizes that in chapter 14, when we get over there, you'll see that a lot of these things are designed to keep them separate. What's another word for separate? What's that? Okay. There's another one, though, that means that we don't often think about holy. Exactly. Holy. And how many times do you remember them saying, the theme of the book of Leviticus, in fact, is, you are to be holy because I am holy. What did he mean by that? Did he mean that they were supposed to be God? No. They are to set themselves apart and to follow God. And that's going to distinguish them from the people around them. So in looking at this mandate to not listen to the people around them, to only listen to their God, there's an interesting piece that happens in chapter 13. Normally, how did they understand God's word? Did God speak directly to them? No. How did he make his word known to them, his law known to them? Okay, through prophets and through revelation to certain key people. What was a common way for people to know that that person really did speak from God? Okay, they were a prophet, which means they could, there was a spokesperson, but quite often they would say things that would then come true and demonstrate that their message was from God. Or they would be able to perform some sort of miracle. If you look at Elijah and Elisha, good examples of that in the Old Testament, where the prophets could also do miracles. And yet we begin here in chapter 13 where he says, if a prophet or a dreamer arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods whom you have not known, and let us serve them. You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall follow the Lord your God and fear him, and you shall keep his commandments. Listen to his voice. Serve him. Cling to him. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has counseled rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt, redeemed you from the house of slavery, to seduce you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you. Now that may not seem like all that complicated a piece there, but I think there are many things that stem from this that help us understand, especially, how the Jews reacted to Christ. They think of their history from here to the time they get to Christ. They go into the land, they conquer the land, period of the judges, what happens? They follow God, they get fined, they quit following God, they go down, they come up, they're listening to other people, they're adopting idolatry. Idolatry was their curse until they got to Babylon. And finally, it was purged from their system. So the group of Jews that came out of Babylon and came back to the land never again had a problem with idolatry, but in that sense, they were paranoid about ever violating these commandments here again, adopting the gods around them, or listening to a prophet or a dreamer who's going to try to lead them astray. So simply being able to foretell something, was that sufficient to say that that person spoke for God? What also had to be just part of that message? It had to be in line with what God's law already said. Now think about it for a second. Go ahead. Yes. Jesus quite often quoted the Old Testament, and he was not trying to change things. And in fact, if you look at a lot of the teachings of Christ, he was teaching the Jews how to be proper Jews in many cases, and how to fulfill the law properly. He was there to fulfill the law. And if you look at someone's reaction to Christ, they were going to have a hard time thinking about this. And it really comes down to a point where some of the things that he taught, they would be able to look at the old law and say, yeah, That's exactly right. Until it comes to one key point. When he basically equated himself with God. When Jesus equated himself with God, the Jews had a really, really tough decision to make. Because that was either blasphemy, and he was one of these right here from Deuteronomy 13. Don't listen to the guy. What are you supposed to do with him? Kill him. Or what? He was telling the truth, and he was the Son of God. And I tell you, folks, we look back on history and wonder how in the world they couldn't see it, but I look at it from a different viewpoint. I look at it if I was there, and with that kind of history and with that kind of background, wondering what choice I would have made. Because they were steeped in this. And a lot of the common people really wanted to follow God. They didn't start trying to kill him, though.
Well, no.
Yeah.
There were
many of them were. If you look at the teachings, many of them were against him from a standpoint of he was superseding some of the people there in terms of just position or hierarchy. But if you watch it and follow it through, the serious efforts to kill him started when he started proclaiming he was God. Now, there may have been some in the higher rulers who would have liked to have done away with him, you know, regardless, simply because he was teaching things that they were against. But the common Jews would have had a hard time with this. And they would have had a hard time because this had been ingrained in their system. You got to be careful what you hear. Now, let's put it in a modern day perspective. Okay? There are a lot of groups today who claim to have modern day revelation. Okay? Some new message from God. And some of them claim, they'll just put it down, okay, claim to have done some sort of miracle or, you know, something that would then engender folks to say, yes, okay, this person might be speaking from God. But wouldn't this same kind of guideline apply? Is that once the law has been laid down and that covenant is in place, when the prophets came along during the time of the judges, during the time of the kings, did they come along and try to change the law? What was their message, always? What? Yeah, get back to it, right? Reaffirm it. Start obeying it. Get back to what Moses said. So if we had a modern-day person who actually did come from God, not that I'm expecting that or whatever, what would their message be, or should it be? Shouldn't it be the same? Get back to God? Look at the law?
I think the major difference between what happened between the Old and New Testament and what happened between the New Testament and now is that in the Old Testament, God told the people there is something else coming. He talked about a new covenant that he was going to establish with his people. In the New Testament, it clearly says
this is it. Yep.
No.
Absolutely. So we do have that as a change too. That in the old law there was, and we looked at it when we were studying the book of Hebrews, of the things that were coming forward. And of course in Hebrews it says, in these last days he's spoken to us by his son. We've got the trump card there. And so it's a little hard in this day and age for us to look at someone who comes in with a new revelation to say, oh, I've got some new news. And things aren't quite like what you're reading in your Bible. I got a new message for you. I think the same kind of principle applies.
As then and now, there have always been false prophets.
Yes. Always have been. Always have been. There were a lot of them during the time of Christ. There were a lot of false messiahs during the time of Christ. So sorting through it and figuring out what's right isn't always an easy task. And I think that's where he is enjoining these people to listen carefully and to not put up with those who are trying to subvert the word and subvert the law.
I like what some said in John 7. They said, when the Christ comes, will he do any more than what this man
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think those who were honest of heart and who would look at what he did, and of course, a lot of what people would have heard was just heard about what he did too. And so there were enough, but enough eyewitnesses start piling up, and you got to wonder, was he the right place? But you also have to realize it's really hard to give up what you've held on to for so long. It's really hard to admit that something's changing, that things are different.
Paul was one of those that had a tough time with it.
Paul had a very tough time with it, and it took direct intervention for him. And not everybody gets that. He got it. And we look at him as a good example of someone who, you know, he'd heard the teachings and he was there. But then it was just really hard for him to kick against the ox goad, right? But he got it. And I think Moses was expecting that they would have a lot of these problems. And part of what he's doing here is saying, don't let it even get started. Okay, so he started first on with a prophet or a dreamer. He says, you get somebody like that, if they're not teaching God's word, don't listen to them. Look at verses 6 through 10, or 11. He says, if your brother, your mother's son, or your son or daughter, or the wife you cherish, or your friend who is in your own soul entice you secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, whom neither you nor your fathers have known, of the gods of the peoples who are around you, near you, or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other, you shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eyes shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. Your hands shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterwards the hands of all the people. So you shall stone him to death because he has sought to seduce you from the Lord your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid and will never again do such a wicked thing among you. So the prophet or dreamer, okay, that's one thing. Who's the next category of people he's talking about here? Yeah. Family, really close friends, folks that you really have a tough time thinking they're wrong. Don't listen to them. Now, when he says that you're to kill them, he is not saying that they are on their own, just immediately, you know, pull out the knife and just stab them kind of thing, because he explains it later on. How are they to be killed? They're stoned. Okay, that was a public execution. The point there was, he says, your hand will be first against them. They were to lead the stoning. But it was to be public, okay? And, you know, there's a little problem in this day and age with the death penalty. What was the reason that he said that he instituted the death penalty for this? What was that last verse we looked at there? What was the purpose? That they might be afraid, and it might not be done again in Israel. It was supposed to be a deterrent. It was supposed to be a deterrent. Now, we know from history it wasn't always enforced. And people didn't always do the right thing. And I'm sure there were instances of people who were thinking about it and decided not to do it because they didn't want their relatives to be the ones to pull them off and toss them down the pit to be stoned. But the deterrent factor was there in their law. And if nothing else, it shows that God's very serious about this.
It's a bit off topic, but it's without for 1 minute condoning the Muslim world today. You know, they really are following, you know, in a lot of precepts, the old law.
Yes. They are in some respects. Now, they've taken it a step further, and that's one of the reasons that I brought out. It's really not off topic. I was planning to go there. On this particular one, it says, you shall kill them, okay? But it was in a public arena. And we know from other places that they weren't to take just one person's word for something. And so there were still judicial processes that had to be gone through for this. They're just not all laid out right here, that you have to put everything together for it. One of the main differences in a lot of the Muslim culture and some of the others, for example, this deal where a man's daughter does something that he doesn't like, he doesn't have to take her before anybody or do anything. He just kills her, drags her body out, and said she did something that defaced the family. And their law says, okay, that's different. That's very different. Because it now is just one person's word against another. And what happens when you start with anyone can rat on somebody else and then that person automatically gets punished? Has that ever worked? It's never worked. They're having a big problem in China right now. They have a budget in China for what they call social contentment. It's larger than their military budget. And it consists of money that they pay to their network of people to spy on their friends and neighbors. It's not working real well right now. Okay, they're having some problems. That kind of thing, people just, are they greedy? Yeah, they'll take advantage of stuff like that. When it's just in one person's hand, it's equivalent to what we see later when he says, every man does what's right in his own eyes, regardless of how he got that vision of what's right or wrong. So in here, this isn't a loophole that you could then go accusing your relative of this. There would have to be some sort of process by which you demonstrate that it was the truth. So, don't listen to a dreamer. Don't let your family disrupt you. This next section, we're not going to read all of it, but I want you to notice here, he says that if you hear of one of your cities, which the Lord your God is giving you to live in, anyone saying that some worthless men have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods. So if they found basically a town where everyone had gone off and was now serving some other god, take a guess. What was the punishment? You lead down. Yeah, destroy the town. Burn it as a whole burnt offering to God. They were to kill all the people, destroy the town, and not take any loot or booty from it. There was no profit in doing this. Okay? They were to simply destroy everything. Now, doesn't that seem a bit extreme? Our day and age, you know, that would be linked to something called, you know, like genocide or something, right? There were a lot of extremes. And if you look at one of the overarching principles of they were to be kept separate and be kept a holy group, this was one of the ways in that society that God was trying to keep them separate, but also to take vengeance on those people in that land. So why can't we just go around and just kill everybody today who doesn't think like we do and doesn't hold to the truth? What's the difference today?
The big difference is that God's opened it up to the whole world and all mankind at the same time.
Yeah. So there are a lot of differences, right? A lot of differences. And one of the things is the fact that God made it very clear in Romans and other places that vengeance is mine, right? And so in our age, God is the one who is going to take care of this. It's not our place to do it anymore. And so when people get upset over modern day issues that we have, and you might, and some of them are well known, you know, abortion, homosexuality, some things like that, it doesn't make them any less wrong. But we do not have this Old Testament right to go stake out the abortion clinic and burn it down because they don't, you know, believe what God said. And that's the mistake a lot of people make, is they take some of this Old Testament justice, some of this Old Testament justification, in the way that God had the people of Judah and Israel live for that covenant group, and they try to move all of it forward. Now, did God still teach that we as Christians are to be separate from the world? Is that still part of the overarching principle that God wants for his people? Absolutely. But the way that we have to do it is going to be a little different. And there's more of it that comes in terms of keeping them separate. If you go over to the next chapter, in chapter 14, there are... Yes, go ahead.
We don't have authorization to go burn it down, but we have a responsibility to not recite it.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that.
Plenty of action
I agree with you fully, and we could get into a big, long discussion on that. I was not meaning by that to say that, oh, we just have to meekly accept everything. No. We can speak out. Our responsibility is to teach and to take a stand for what's right. What it doesn't, what we don't have, is the militant arm of that. It's not up to us to go punish people who don't agree with us.
And those groups exist.
They do. They do. And that's one of the reasons I'm bringing it up, is they try to hide behind this shield of the Bible to say, the Bible gives me the right to go do this. And it does not. But it does absolutely enjoin us to take a stand for the truth and to say what's right. And that, I think, sometimes we don't do enough of. And coming future, get off topic really here on that one, we're going to have some difficult times ahead. And those are things that we need to think about in terms of standing for God's law. You are the sons of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave your forehead for the sake of the dead. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Two verses there with the same general declaration. You're chosen of God. You are sons of God. You are to be a holy people. That same echo comes with Christians in this age. We are sons of God. We are to be a holy people. Now, he gives some other things there that are kind of interesting. He says they're not to cut themselves. And over in Leviticus, it actually it says both cut themselves or tattoo themselves. I think it's dealing with these ritual things. There were people who had all kinds of scarring that they would do on themselves and things, either part of their religion or mourning for the dead. There are all kinds of cultic practices related to that. And God says, you're not supposed to do anything like that. You'll see over and over that we're to respect the temple that God lives in, our bodies. And so there's a lot that other people did not respect about their bodies that the Old Testament begins with and the New Testament continues, of at least respecting what we have in terms of this physical shell that God has given us for a while, regardless of how imperfect it might be. We are not to go disfiguring it, doing those kinds of things on purpose. Then he goes into dietary laws. And I'm not going to read through all of these. We're just going to take a couple of quick things. He goes in lots of lists of animals. He says they're going to have clean things and unclean things. So, for example, he lists a bunch of animals in verses 4 and 5, deer and goats and whatnot. But then he gives a general rule in verse 6. Any animal that divides the hoof and has the hoof split in two and chews the cud among the animals that you may eat. Now, I like this simply because it's an and statement. And then he goes on and explains it. It's got to divide the hoof and chew the cud. So what if it divides the hoof and doesn't chew the cud? Nope, not. Doesn't meet the requirements there, right? What about the other way around? Nope, doesn't meet the requirements. And he goes and lists those. And he goes, no. These animals do one and not the other. And these animals do one and not the other. And so then people like to second guess all of this. Now it becomes, well, why couldn't they eat these other things? I don't know. We can second guess for a long time here. You know, pigs, okay, they've got trichinosis and other things, but you know what? You can cook the meat well enough that it doesn't necessarily get it. And if that was really the reason, how come Peter, in the same basic, you know, sanitary requirements, was told, nah, it's okay now? You know, some of it you look at and you go, some of them are listed, they're scavengers, carrion eaters, those kinds of things, and contact with death was something that was also prohibited for them. So there's some explanations in there that make some sense. But here's the point. Did they need to know why? Did they need to know why they could eat a goat and not a pig? No. And I think that's one of the things that drives us crazy, isn't it? When kids first start learning, what's their first question? Why? Right? We always want to know why. And sometimes there is no why. There is one why here. There is one why here. Why did God set up these laws of all these things they could eat and they couldn't eat? What was it part of? Discipline. Okay. Excellent. What's that? It set them apart. Could Daniel just go eat anything when he got hauled off into Babylon if he was going to stay a faithful Jew? Why not? Well, he didn't know what all was being served and where it had come from, or maybe even what kind of meat it was. I've often wondered why he wanted vegetables only, but then I got thinking about it. They would have eaten a variety of clean and unclean things, but did he necessarily get a choice as to what served up on his plate that day? And so if you don't know, sometimes it's best just to do without, right? And I think that was basically what Daniel was doing, was saying, oh, I may not know what's on this plate. It may not be what God wants, so I am going to stay separate. I'm going to stay holy and obey the law. So he gives all the rules. Verse 9, you can eat anything in the water that has fins and scales. Now, in general, he's going to list some other things. But did he make it complicated? I mean, we get to the lists of things. You can do these. And that sounds kind of complicated. But in reality, it was a pretty simple rule, right? You lift the hoof. Yep, divided. Does it chew its cud? Yep, dinner. You catch something in the water, what do you look at? Got fins, got scales, dinner. It wasn't hard. Sometimes we get caught up in the complications of things, right? I like shrimp. I love shrimp. Shrimp weren't on the diet. Why? They got scales, sort of. No fins. It wasn't hard, folks. And a lot of what God was laying down for these people wasn't designed to make their lives miserable. Could they eat well on the diet that God was allowing them? He wasn't punishing them in this way. He was giving them something to set them apart. Okay. Now, verse 21 is a verse that is a little difficult for folks, and mostly because we have no idea. You shall not eat anything that dies of itself. That's very clear. You may give it to the aliens who are in your town so that he may eat it, or you may sell it to a foreigner, for you are a holy people to the Lord your God. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. This one line has led to some very interesting dietary restrictions by a lot of modern Jews. How many of you are aware of what it means to really have a kosher kitchen? Yeah. That's two sets of everything. And dairy products, cheese, milk, those kinds of things, shall never touch the same pots, pans, plates, forks, etc., that any kind of meat product does. And that way, you are guaranteeing that you will not violate this particular command. I'm not sure that's what it was really intended to do there, but this is another one where we'll just have to find out later what the whole point was. There are some references to some Ugaritic scripts where there were some rituals where they did, you know, save up and cook, you know, the calf and its mother's milk kind of thing. It may have been related to cruelty. It may have been related to simply the heathen practices. We don't know. It's just laid down here. And it's a perfect example of how people can take something simple and make it very complicated, which people have done over the years. But also, there's a hint, to me anyway, in this verse, when he says, if something dies of itself, you can't eat it. But you can do what? You can give it to the aliens in your land, or you can sell it to the foreigners. So was there, now that sounds kind of weird in a way, but was there inherently anything wrong with it? See, that's the point. God had simply said, you don't do that. This keeps you separate. These other folks, they're not part of you. They can do it. It's kind of hard sometimes when our kids see people doing things, they say, why can't I do that? And the answer is, well, we're not one of them. And that would have been the answer here. You know, why can't we do this? Well, because you're not one of them. You're separate. He talks about tithes next. They were to tithe all the produce from which they sow, which came out of the field every year, and they were to eat it in the presence of the Lord your God at the place where he chooses to establish his name, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil, your firstborn of your herd and your flock, in order that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. And then he goes down and lays out the regulations that if they were a far distance from the central sanctuary when it came time to present their tithes and their offerings, that they could convert those to money and take money there, and then they would have a feast, basically, at this place. And it says that they were to eat of the first fruits and the tithes. It doesn't mean that they consumed all of them. It means that this feast was provided out of that. What was the main point, if you look back in Leviticus, of the tithes? Who did it support? It supported the priests and the Levites, okay, because they didn't have an inheritance. They didn't have land other than the cities of refuge where they could grow, and it's an agricultural society. What was the job of the Levites? I mean, were they just the idlers to sit around because they don't have any land to work? Kind of get that picture sometimes, right?
They taught the law.
They were the teachers, okay? They taught the law, but it turns out they did a lot more. They ran the schools, and a lot of the just public infrastructure that we can think of actually fell down to the Levites because they didn't have the land to do, and so they were available for a lot of this. They kept the communication lines going between the other Levites and the cities. The flow of information was quite often through the Levites. So they played an integral part of society, and as such, this tithe was a combination, really, of the civil and religious taxes. Because the civil and religious was the same, right? They were literally one nation under God. So they had this, but they were to take these things to the central place. And this gets emphasized over and over again, that they were to go there. And part of that had to do with the when they offered these tithes is very difficult because there are some who, if you look at it, think that it was only brought during like the Feast of the Harvest, but it also mentions first fruits. Sometimes first fruits would not have lasted the entire season if you're talking like first fruits of fruits and vegetables or something like that, the first part of the harvest. The firstborn from the flock, certainly they could keep around for any number of time and then, you know, drive them to central place. So we don't really know all of the exact ins and outs of how a lot of this worked. A lot of it came down through tradition. We can read about, you know, especially during from Babylonian captivity afterwards, we've got some pretty good idea of how they did a lot of this and the rituals and things behind it. But what we really need to keep in mind is that God established a framework that would work for keeping both the religious and the civil government going and keeping people in remembrance of Him. So there's a couple of key parts of this. There's the tax, the tithe, that they were to offer. And a little further on, it talks about every third year, they actually were to store it up in that city locally. And they were not to neglect the Levite that was among them. So they were enjoined to make sure that people had enough to eat and that these people were taken care of. And they had the civil infrastructure then to maintain what they needed for a government. So God put it all in place for them. He didn't really leave anything out for when they were going into this land. So in verse 28, it talks about every third year they were deposited in their own town, and the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien, and the orphan, and the widow who are in your town shall come and eat and be satisfied in order that the Lord your God may bless you. Now, that's the other piece there, is that the Levites were pretty much responsible for the welfare of others that were talking there, the orphans and the widows and those. When that was all brought in and given to the Levites, it was all their portion, they were then responsible for making sure that other people got taken care of.
In a sense, there was no separation of church and state.
Yeah, there was none. The church was the state, absolutely, absolutely. And so all of their laws and regulations were set up on that basis. Okay, so chapter 15, and we just have a couple of minutes to hit a couple of things. This is talking about release of debts. Every 7 years they grant a remission of debts. And this is the manner of the remission. Every creditor shall release what he has loaned to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor and his brother, because the Lord's remission has been proclaimed. From a foreigner you may exact it, but your hand shall release whatever of yours is with your brother. However, there shall be no poor among you, since the Lord will bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess. This is, seems kind of strange here. So somebody comes, they're having problems, and you loan them something. Now, normally when you loan somebody something, what's expected? They pay you back. But when it got to the seventh year, every 7 years, there was this thing called remission. What happened? Debts get canceled. They don't have to pay you back. Unless they're a foreigner, right? There's several things we don't have time for in this chapter to go into great detail, so I'll just cover a couple of them briefly. They could loan money to other folks and expect to get it back. And one of the statements that it makes is that they could loan money to the kings, but they were never to borrow from the kings. And if you look at Jewish history, even into the modern age, one of the things that you will find that they are always involved in is commerce and banking. They're always very successful at it. Guess who funded much of the exploration of the New World? Were effectively Jewish banks. They bailed out a lot of kings in a lot of times because every seventh year didn't matter to them that they had to do the release thing. So they were the bankers in the world. And God says, that's fine, you can do that, but don't get in debt yourself. Now there's two statements that we'll cover briefly next week because I want to talk a little bit about it. There's this first one here where it says, there won't be any poor among you. But if you go down just a little bit further, it says, there will always be poor among you. So that sounds like two opposites, and we'll have to figure out how to reconcile that next week. Thank you.